From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Trump stood in the Rose Garden yesterday to announce the U.S. withdrawal from the International Climate Accord.
I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
World leaders reacted immediately, condemning the decision. Here's French President Emmanuel Macron.
We all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
And a major bombing in the heart of Kabul took the lives of more than 90 people.
Everything was destroyed in my location. I don't know what happened. There were lots of workers. A lot of people were murdered. All the people who were on the street were killed.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Susan Page of USA Today, Michael Shear of Time, and On Point analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the president's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord? Who wins? Who loses? Do you think it was a smart move or a tragic one? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today, welcome very much to the show.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
And also Washington Bureau Chief for Time, Michael Shearer, welcome to you as well. Both of you are from Washington in a studio with us today.
Yep, thanks for having me, Sasha.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Sasha, Susan, and Michael.
So let's talk about Paris first. That is clearly the issue making gigantic headlines. And this is, as with anything involving Trump, there are polar opposite takes on this from people who say it's absolutely tragic. There was a top environmental negotiator under Clinton and George W. Bush who said that this is the worst thing for brand America since Abu Ghraib. There are other people that are saying it was only ever a symbolic pact. It's hardly going to make a difference. The market forces and local and state governments can fill the void in terms of what the federal government doesn't do. Who would like to jump in first and give your take on how momentous is this or is this not?
Well, you know, I would just say it may be momentous or not, but it should not be seen as surprising because this is a decision that's totally consistent with what candidate Donald Trump said during the campaign. And the fact is, while there was furious lobbying of him, there was never really a sign, I think, from Donald Trump that he was going to change his mind about whether he wanted to pull out of this accord.
And remind us, Michael Shear, how about you? Remind us what he says are the basics. He talks about saving money, preserving jobs. Why does he say this was a bad deal?
Well, so the structure of the Paris Accords is rather unique. It did not commit any country to any specific number. It allowed countries to voluntarily state how much carbon reduction they would have over a period of time. And then it created a transparent process for reporting those numbers so that the world could basically keep track of carbon emissions. And then there was a separate track in which wealthier countries would support developing countries in moving away from carbon to reduce their emissions. That last part is something that the president has long objected to generally. He doesn't think the United States should be in the business of subsidizing the world's dealing with the world's problems. And in his speech yesterday in the Rose Garden, he made quite a bit of this, specifically calling out the money that we had committed to send overseas as something that he was not going to embrace going forward. Now, the question that is open is what will then happen to U.S. carbon emissions over the next 10 or 20 years if we do remove ourselves from this agreement? And it does take 4 years, so this is a gradual process. And we don't really know the answer to that. Like, as you said, states can step up, private industry can step up and reduce carbon emissions on their own, regardless of what the federal policy is. But it's also true that the president is pushing forward on a number of tracks to make it easier to send carbon into the atmosphere, with the argument that it could make electricity prices cheaper going forward. It could help parts of the country, especially coal country, that have been hurt rather badly, primarily from natural gas, but also from regulations in recent years.
Let's hear part of what Trump did say in the Rose Garden. Let's hear his own words. Here's part of what he said in terms of how he believed that the Paris Accord was holding the United States back.
The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States to the exclusive benefit of other countries, leaving American workers, who I love, and taxpayers to absorb the cost in terms of lost jobs, lower wages, shuttered factories, and vastly diminished economic production.
Jack Beatty, do you have a view on whether this accord was going to be as disadvantageous to the U.S. as Trump makes it out to be?
It doesn't seem to be so. Washington Post fact checker, looking at his speech, found his dire prognostications based on very flawed research, canned research paid for by the Chamber of Commerce, and without credibility. He also cited a study from MIT saying, oh, this is just a tiny amount of carbon reduction to be got from this. And MIT people said, yes, but it's a beginning and we don't mean to derogate it. You know, what strikes me, we can't know about the future, Sasha. We can't really know what's going to happen. But we can know something about the past, it seems to me. And the question is, how did we get here? And I want to put the mirror to us in the media. I've looked into this. In the campaign, in the four debates that were held, including the vice presidential debate, there was not one single question about the difference in the candidates, their different positions on climate change, and what difference it would make to the American people. And in the on the networks, and including Fox, and including the Sunday shows, there was not a single segment on what to expect on Clinton and on Trump on climate change.
But do you think
even if there had been,
do you think that would have changed any voters' minds?
I do not know. I do not know. But I do know that that was an abdication of responsibility on the part of those journalists. This is the most pressing issue before the before the planet. And they couldn't bring themselves to ask a single question about it.
Let's hear more from Trump in terms of what he said in the Rose Garden, in the ways he believed that the U.S. in particular got a bad deal and other countries were getting off easier.
The fact that the Paris deal hamstrings the United States while empowering some of the world's top polluting countries should dispel any doubt as to the real reason why foreign lobbyists wish to keep our magnificent country tied up and bound down by this agreement. It's to give their country an economic edge over the United States. That's not going to happen while I'm president. I'm sorry.
Susan Page, he's referring in part to the fact that this accord had a subsidy element in a sense where developing nations donated to a fund that would help developing countries, and he just didn't think that was fair. He thought it was costing us money, that we had to have tougher standards than other countries did. Give us your sense of how much maybe there was an imbalance of what the U.S. was required, or not required, but the U.S. agreed to do versus other countries.
Well, the U.S. was definitely one of the leaders under President Obama in pushing for this accord and doing the negotiations that enabled to be almost universal, 195 nations joining it. But, you know, I think what we fundamentally see here with the Trump administration is a different attitude toward the idea of, are we in a global community, which I think is how the Obama people sought a global community where it'd be in our interest to help developing nations have cleaner energy? Or are we in a global competition, which I think is how the Trump team would see it, in which we don't want to help out others because it's a zero-sum game and it's to our detriment if we do that?
Let's go to a caller. This is Jimmy calling from Racine, Wisconsin. Jimmy, welcome to On Point and your thoughts about the United States withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord.
I think it's a bad deal. Washington is pretty much irrelevant when it comes to climate change. Now, I have no confidence in our top elected officials, regardless if they're Democrat Party or Republican Party. Obama administration's got their fingerprints all over the Keystone Pipeline. It's just business as usual when it comes to climate change in Washington. This needs to be a grassroots movement. It has to be done by the states, local levels, city level. Communities have to get involved. You just got to go from the ground up. Washington is pretty much irrelevant when it comes to combating climate change.
Jimmy, when you said bad deal, are you saying you never thought it was all it was cracked up to be, no big loss that we're leaving it?
I wasn't surprised. I don't even think the Obama administration had any confidence in the agreement when we signed it or when he passed it along in the accord. It's just frustrating. It's a lot of rhetoric, but very little action, and it's been kind of like the same for the last 20, 30 years in the United States when it comes to climate change and global warming.
Jimmy, thanks for that. Let's hear California Governor Jerry Brown. He was fiercely critical of President Trump's decision yesterday to leave Paris, and this is speaking this morning.
It is taking America out of the mainstream of the world and going backwards into the dark ages of climate misunderstanding. That's for one. But in another way, it's going to so polarize the country and so galvanize the opposition that actually the climate action effort and coalition will get much stronger.
Jack Beatty, that's a very interesting point. You know, could this, in a unexpected way, bring together local governments, state governments, universities, businesses to fill the void where the government is backing out? Could this strengthen climate change prevention efforts in the United States?
Well, I guess it has that potential. I just don't know enough about the factors involved as to whether it will galvanize a political reaction. That remains to be seen. I mean, Mr. Trump said, I was elected to represent Pittsburgh, not Paris. Well, in fact, he lost Pittsburgh by 80%. Hillary got 80% of the vote there, and the mayor said, we're going to continue with our efforts to make a better environment. But the Trump decision was aimed right at the states, Pennsylvania being one. He mentioned Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, that he won, and that that's his base strategy. You know, so yes, it may galvanize a huge reaction on part of elite opinion on either coast. But what about the heartland? What about the people that put Trump in office? How are they going to move on this?
Murray Energy, a big sort of a coal company based in Ohio, applauded this. He called it following through on President Trump's promise. He's supporting America's uncompromising values, saving coal jobs, promoting low-cost, reliable electricity for Americans and the rest of the world. That's a supporter. We will be back after a break. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week's top stories. Join this conversation. Let us know what you expect to hear from fired FBI Director James Comey if he testifies next week. Does Putin's denial of sanctioned Kremlin hacking in the U.S. presidential election ring true to you? My guests this hour are Susan Page of USA Today, Michael Scheer of Time, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Susan, Michael, and Jack, let's move on to Jared Kushner, who's very much been in the news this past week, because U.S. intelligence services apparently intercepted a message that Russia's ambassador sent to the Kremlin. And the ambassador said that last December, Kushner told him that he wanted a private back channel to communicate with Moscow, perhaps even using Russia's secret communications equipment to do it. So let's talk first about back channels. How alarming does this sound? How common are they? How typically have they been used in history? Any one of you sort of the historical expert here on this?
Well, there have been back channels used, both true back channels, in which they're very quietly done, and sort of informal back channels where you use a third country to do a negotiation. When we released the Taliban prisoners, there were negotiations that were held not directly with the Taliban. We used a third party. The best historical example is probably Nixon's efforts to undermine the Paris Peace Accords in the Vietnam War before he was elected. He had a back channel to South Vietnam urging them not to cut a deal, saying if he got elected, the deal would be better. This infuriated President Johnson. So they're not illegal. They're not without precedent. What makes this one interesting is that it's more smoke in an already very smoky room. We don't know exactly what the relationship was between the Trump campaign and the Russians, what the real agenda was between the Trump operation and the Russians. A number of things the Trump operation has said over time has sort of fallen away. You know, they've claimed no contacts with Russian officials, then we find out they're contacts. And so the fact that this was happening at a time when the Obama administration was really clamping down on Russia for really what was a historic intervention in our elections, that also makes this more interesting than past cases. Now, from the perspective of Kushner and the White House, they continue to maintain, even though they're not directly addressing this in the press, that there was nothing untoward here. This was all regular business. The transitions regularly meet with diplomats. And they've said that they're willing to testify. Kushner said he's willing to testify in an appropriate venue about what was going on. And it's likely, although not certain, that the ongoing independent counsel investigation by Bob Mueller will also get to the bottom of this. So I think there's more shoes to drop.
Susan, let me come right back to you. Let's hear a little piece of sound from someone who doesn't think the back channel is a big deal. This is Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly. He says no problem.
It's both normal, in my opinion, and acceptable. There's any way that you can communicate with people, particularly organizations that are maybe not particularly friendly to us, is a good thing.
So again, that's the Homeland Security Secretary. Then we have Congressman Adam Schiff. He's a ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. He told ABC this week that his concern is not so much about the back channel as about Jared Kushner's honesty when he was approved for his security clearance.
If these allegations are true and he had discussions with the Russians about establishing a back channel and didn't reveal that, that's a real problem.
And Susan Page, what were you going to say right before these two cuts of tape?
Well, I was going to say there are questions about whether when you have back channels in the past, including Robert Kennedy was a back channel to Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. There are examples for many administrations in one circumstance or another. Unusual to do it before you're in office, although there is the Nixon example that Michael talked about. Unusual to use your 36-year-old son-in-law who has no diplomatic experience to be a back channel to one of the United States' biggest adversaries on the globe. I think that raised some questions. And also, an interesting story in the Washington Post this morning that says while the Trump team says this was a back channel to talk about Syrian diplomatic affairs, officials at the Russian bank involved say they were financial discussions, and we know that the Kushner company was seeking financing for some almost desperately seeking financing for some real estate deals, and that maybe they were going to Russia for financing and trying to do this before the actual inauguration. Either of those explanations raises questions about the appropriateness of this contact.
Right,
Last thing, it gets very close to the president. Unlike Michael Flynn, who's been dumped overboard, or Carter Page, who was not very close to Trump, this is someone who is in his family and one of his closest advisors.
Right. It's increasingly spreading the FBI probe to the White House. And the bank reference, by the way, was, of course, a reference to Kushner also having met in December with the head of a big Russian bank. The bank says the talks were just about Kushner's role as head of his family real estate business. Let's go to a caller. This is Michael from Austin, Texas. Michael, your thoughts on this Russia situation?
Well, so my opinion on this is that this is actually the much more poignant story that's going on right now. And that yesterday's action on the climate accord was just literally the red herring for the base in his home states, where he's saying, okay, look, I'm fulfilling a promise. I'm doing what you asked me to do as a total distraction from what is emerging as proof of, complicity in the meddling with the election.
Oh, Michael, that's interesting. Jack Beatty, what do you think about that? I mean, certainly many people have watched Trump's strategy, and when bad news comes out, he does something else, they believe, to distract from that bad news. Do you feel like that's partly what Paris is?
The blow-up of Paris. Certainly we're going to be talking about it a lot, but it hasn't noticed. It hasn't forced us to abandon what Michael talked about, the smoke-filled room here of revelations and leaks about the potential collusion with Russia during the campaign. This picture of collusion gained some traction in a source story in Yahoo News yesterday by Michael Isikoff, who reports, quoting people by name from the State Department, about an effort by the fledgling Trump administration, the first few weeks of the administration, to roll back, asking the State Department to find out how to begin to roll back the sanctions on Russia that the president put on Russia after the Crimea and after the incursion into Ukraine, the eastern Ukraine. That there was a good deal of pressure about, we want to get out of that. We want to roll back these sanctions, and we want to do it unilaterally. That is, the requests from the White House weren't, well, what can we get from this? It was unilateral concessions. That blew over partly because the State Department people sabotaged it. They called John McCain, they called other people, and there was some movement on the Hill to have a bill that would essentially freeze the sanctions in law. But it was there, nevertheless, an immediate kind of unilateral interest in having unilateral concessions to Russia. What could that possibly be about?
We have a caller from Springfield, Massachusetts. This is Bill. Bill, welcome to On Point, and your thoughts about the Russia situation.
I just have a feeling that a lot of this stuff is just made up news just to keep the downward spiral of Trump moving downward. Anything he does seems to just take on its own life in the news about Russia. I mean, everybody that steps forward with anything gets Russia, Russia, Russia.
When you say made up news, do you actually not believe that what's being reported is correct?
I believe that there's more talking heads making news about it than there is actual news. For 7 months, they've been investigating, and there's nothing. They found nothing. There's just more little avenues to chase down the little Russia mouse down the hole, and they bring in a new talking head every day to make a new statement about the next latest thing he said that has nothing to do with Russia. And so, it seems like it's just busy news to keep the downward spiral of Trump.
So it's possible next week that the former FBI director, Jim Comey, will testify. Do you have any expectation, Bill, of what you expect to hear?
I expect he'll say that there's nothing there. I really don't think there's anything there. I think John Podesta had some ties to Russia. That's been documented, and so did Hillary Clinton.
Bill, thanks for that. Michael Scheer, your sense of what might come from Jim Comey's testimony if he does testify?
Yeah, I would just say to the caller, there's certainly a lot of talking heads talking about Russia and Trump, but the president has done quite a bit of talking about this as well. And much of the news about this is because of what the president's actions are, including firing James Comey after, according to Comey, repeatedly asking him to back off various parts of the investigation, including the Flynn matter, including tweeting regularly about alleged wiretapping or improper surveillance, which has not been in any way substantiated by the Obama administration of his campaign. In previous public appearances, the FBI director has said that this is all a matter of investigation that he thinks is worth looking into. He has not made any conclusions about whether there's anything here or not here, but he's definitely putting his full effort into investigating it, or was. And I think so. I don't expect him to say nothing to see here. And I do expect him, given James Comey's history here, to testify very forthrightly about everything President Trump told him privately about the investigation. He has an enormous interest in maintaining his own reputation. It's always been the guiding light, for better or worse, of the decisions he's made. And so, you know, next Thursday, we're going to have another round of stories that will make the caller unhappy because, you know, more will be known then than now about exactly what the president was doing in the first months of this of his presidency to try and push aside this Russia matter.
Yesterday, Vladimir Putin himself, the Russian president, weighed in on this Russia controversy. And this is after months of blanket denials by Putin that Russia had any involvement in possible cyber attacks on the U.S. presidential election. He's now saying that, you know, maybe some Russian citizens did some hacking on their own. He's saying they wake up in the morning today, read that something is going on in international relations. If they are patriots, they start to contribute their opinions in order to fight against those who speak ill about Russia. Theoretically, it's possible. We don't engage in that on a state level. We also heard this week from Hillary Clinton. She was at a conference in California talking about possible Russian interference in the election. And her speculation is that they had guidance from within the United States.
Who were they coordinating with or colluding with? Because the Russians historically, in the last couple of decades, and then increasingly, you know, are launching cyber attacks. And they are stealing vast amounts of information. And a lot of the information they've stolen, they've used for internal purposes, to affect markets, to affect the intelligence services, et cetera.
Jack Beatty, could you let us know what you think as you hear these sort of dueling comments by Putin and Hillary Clinton?
Well, the Putin comment is really sort of infuriating, isn't it? I mean, he's just saying, well, I mean, as the commentators in the press point out, he's saying what he said about Ukraine, initially about Ukraine, I mean, about Crimea. He said, we're not intervening there. They're Russian tourists are doing this. And then it was little green men. And then months later, yes, we did intervene. And he's been going through that process now. He's about at the little green men stage. And it's infuriating to have him essentially toy with the United States like this. And you ask, well, why would he do this? Well, I mean, you know, CNN reported this week that intercepts of communications with Russian, I guess, with the Russian ambassador over the summer had talk of that Russia had, quote, financial leverage on Mr. Trump, that was the source of their influence on him. And one wonders, when you hear a comment like that, whether they're still essentially exerting that and saying, listen, we don't have anything to fear from you, Mr. Trump, given what we have on you.
We have a caller from Evansville, Indiana. This is Chris. Chris, welcome to On Point, and let us know what you think about the Russia situation.
Hi, Sasha. I'm calling with a question and a statement. The question is, has it been verified that Kushner attempted to use to work this back channel out using the Russian facilities at their embassy? And I just have a general statement regarding Russia and Trump in general in the news.
Sure. And what's the general statement?
It's pretty much the caller before, you know, called mentioning fake news. What I have been hearing for a while now, it seems to me that the media has had to distort the truth to an extent just to try to present a balanced view of this administration, basically because Trump doesn't know what he's doing and he shouldn't be the president.
So when you say the media had to distort the truth to present a balanced view, where is the truth distortion happening to create that balanced view?
Well, I feel as if sometimes the story is edited in a way to, I guess to make the man look a little bit less like an idiot.
Oh, interesting. Susan, could you first answer Chris's question, if possible? Is it just an allegation that Kushner tried to use a back channel using Russian facilities, or do we know that? Has there been an acknowledgement?
There's been reports citing anonymous intelligence sources saying that's the case. The White House hasn't said it's not the case. There have been some speculation that maybe it's some Russian disinformation. But as on many of the things with this story, we don't have the kind of verified, confirmed facts that we will have, I think, by the end of this investigation. Let me just point out something about our last two callers, though. Chris thinks the news media is kind of distorting things to make Trump look better. Bill thinks the news media is distorting things to make Trump look worse. Mm-hmm. And it's really an example of how people are really watching these news developments, these really significant news developments involving the president, through the same partisan lens we've seen with everything else. And it makes it hard to have kind of agreed upon facts on which we can continue to discuss. And if I could just weigh in just briefly on Putin's comments about saying maybe it was just hackers. I think with both Putin and with President Trump, you've seen a little bit of an effort to hedge their denials. So Putin is saying, well, maybe there was some hacking, but it wasn't me. It was patriotic Russian patriots. And President Trump the other day said that he didn't have any contact with Russia, but he can only speak for himself. So in both cases, it seems to me they're acknowledging the fact that there may be disclosures that conflict with their previous flat denials.
Jack Beatty, you'd probably only have 15 seconds for this, but since we do have some callers saying the media is too pro-Trump, the media is too anti-Trump, how does the media do it right if that's what people think?
Well, the media, of course, is a party to these partisan broils. What does Trump say? We're the enemy of the people. And he's convinced a good part of his base that that's so. So it's not like the media is simply a mediator. It's not. To many of his supporters, it's seen as the enemy.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, during a press conference before the NBA Finals, LeBron James was asked about racist graffiti spray-painted on his home in L.A. this week.
No matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know, being black in America is tough. And we got a long way to go.
Also, President Trump confounded the Twitter sphere on Wednesday when he coined a new word. Samantha Bee weighed in on that.
Covfefe. Trump is right. He really does have the best words. And he spelled it right. V before E, except after Z.
And music legend Greg Allman, a founding member of the Allman Brothers, died this week at 69. Midnight Rider is one of the band's best-known songs.
I've got to run to keep rolling.
Listeners, join this weekly news table roundtable conversation. Let us know after this deadly bombing in Kabul this week in Afghanistan, should the U.S. send more troops there? Are you ready for NASA's trip to the sun's atmosphere? And what did you think about Angela Merkel of Germany's comments about Europe needing to go it alone largely and not depend on the U.S. and other places much anymore? My guests this hour are Susan Page of USA Today, Michael Shear of Time, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Michael, Jack, and Susan, in terms of Trump's foreign trip, which he returned from last weekend, the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, described that trip during a press briefing on Tuesday as extremely successful.
This was an extraordinarily successful and historic 9-day trip the president took. He accomplished the return of a strong America to international affairs, rallied civilized nations of the world against terrorism, took real steps towards peace in the Middle East, and renewed our alliances on the basis of both shared interest and shared burdens.
Michael Shear, any way to have an impartial, objective take from you on how that trip went?
Yeah, having Sean say that is more the rule than the exception. He tends to use rather colorful adjectives, the sort that Trump uses to talk about himself when he talks about anything Trump's doing. I think that, you know, the trip was a success in that there were no major blunders by the president, which is an exception more than the rule also.
There was the sort of video that looked like him shoving someone aside to get to the front. That was probably the one thing that got most leaped at in terms of...
Yes, and there were some tough handshakes and, you know, there was a... errant comment after a press availability with Prime Minister Netanyahu, but those were pretty minor. And I think the president largely succeeded without a press conference, notably, since most presidents give press conferences when they're overseas, in keeping on message. And his message was that I am going to reorient American foreign policy to deal-making, and I am going to challenge the global order as it now exists. I think and in his mind and in Sean Spicer's mind, that is a success. I think it's rather concerning for a lot of other people. I think a lot of the NATO allies left the meeting somewhat shaken by the fact that the president did not explicitly endorse Article 5, which is the idea that an attack on any NATO country is an attack on all NATO countries. I think the Pope is rather unhappy today that the president pulled out of the Paris Accords. He made that a big part of that meeting. On the other side, I think the Saudis are very happy to get more than $100 billion in weapons, something they had sought for quite a while, and to find themselves for a few days, thanks to the president of the United States, really at the center of the world, hosting the Arab world and being elevated in stature.
Susan Page, your perspective as Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today on Trump's foreign trip?
You know, I think it really underscored two things. One is the transactional nature of President Trump's approach to the world. That's one reason he was so pleased with the big defense sale to the Saudis, which he said would be good for U.S. companies. There was virtually no talk about moral leadership or human rights or democracy or the treatment of women in Saudi Arabia. That is a big shift from when President Obama, for instance, was traveling in the region. And it also underscored kind of the America first approach that President Trump is taking. You know, whether it's trade or defense with NATO or environmental policy with the Paris Accord, the United States is now increasingly isolated in the world and withdrawing from the kind of leadership that the American president traditionally has shown since the end of World War II. This is a new approach to what role the United States should play in global affairs.
Let's hear another piece of tape from Sean Spicer. This is him commenting in particular on the rapport that Donald Trump has with German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
I think the relationship that the president has had with Merkel, he would describe as fairly unbelievable. They get along very well. He has a lot of respect for her. They continue to grow the bond that they had during their talks in the G7.
Now, there's a somewhat mixed take from Merkel herself. She spoke at a campaign event in Munich last weekend, and she said that her meetings with Trump changed the way that she sees Europe's relationship with the United States. Here's a clip from that speech interpreted by Press TV.
The times in which we can fully count on others are somewhat over, as I've understood over the past few days. Therefore, I can only say that we Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands. Of course, in friendship with the United States, in friendship with Great Britain, and in good neighborly relations, when possible, with Russia and other countries. But we should know that we have to fight for our future ourselves.
Jack Beatty, there were also polar opposite takes on that commentary. Some people said it signaled a radical new world order, different than the one that has stood since World War II. Other people said it's natural, given what's going on in the EU, that Merkel would say Europe really has to focus on itself. How did you read her comments?
Well, the venue is a little disturbing, the historical residence calling to take our fate in our own hands from a Munich beer garden, a German leader doing that. That's a little distressing. And I do think, you know, Ms. Merkel is running for re-election, and I think she's playing the Trump card. And I think that's what that kind of rhetoric represents. The European press, as I read it at least, is alarmed, perhaps over-alarmed by what Trump wrought in that trip. Martin Wolf writing in the Financial Times, this looks like the end of the U.S.-led world order. Well, maybe, but we just can't avoid domestic politics in Europe and playing the Trump card there and insisting that things are much worse than they even are in transatlantic relations. That may well be a winning strategy for Mrs. Merkel.
We have a caller from Tampa, Florida. This is Ken. And Ken, what was your take on Trump's foreign trip?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think the foreign trip was actually a disaster, just based on the fact that anytime Trump stands next to any of the world powers or the foreign leaders of the, major countries around the world, he just looks like a child. Like, it's not even, you can't even compare, especially in the situation where he dealt with Merkel or, any other leader. And I think the fact that the bar sets so low that we take anything he does and as a success, as long as he doesn't make a huge, disastrous mistake, is a case study for a rich white male privilege. Like, the bar is, he can pretty much do anything, just like he said during the campaign. He can shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and it really not be criticized as much as it would be, say, somebody like Barack Obama said that.
Ken, thank you for that. Susan Page, that's tough criticism. You want to venture into your perspective on that caller's view, on Ken's view?
Well, it goes back to the way I think people assess President Trump in based on kind of their views of him. So we know that we hear critics like Ken who think that the bar has been set very low, that as long as there's not some catastrophic misstep, that a trip can be seen as a success. But that very criticism, I think, fuels the sense among Trump supporters that the elites are against him, that he's subjected to criticism and to ridicule, and that it's the same sort of dismissive attitude that they've seen in their own lives when it comes to economic and other culture and cultural problems they faced that weren't getting addressed, that weren't getting heard, that that led to the election of Trump to the White House.
I think there was this hope that Trump and many members of his team had that Europe would kind of follow the American example, and that you would get Marine Le Pen elected in France and other nationalist governments in Austria and the Netherlands. And that hasn't happened so far. And the things that the caller was just saying he objected to are the things that a lot of Trump supporters actually like about him. I mean, he is there to offend the global leadership to some extent. I mean, that's his purpose. He's not trying to fit in. He's not trying to look like one of them. But I think, you know, one of the things that that Europe trip showed was that he still is very much the global outlier right now. And he's trying to come to terms with that.
We have another caller, this one from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. This is Kiana. I hope I've said your name correctly. Welcome to On Point. What did you think of Trump's foreign trip?
Well, actually, I was appalled, absolutely appalled to see. I feel like he has made a mess of things. He's a laughingstock across the world, in a sense. I was deeply saddened, for example, to see him shove a dignitary out of the way in the NATO environment. And I'm thinking, well, that's not an alternative fact. We're seeing it with our own eyes on a video clip. And yet so many of his supporters just ignore that kind of thing. I was quite disturbed. I feel like we've lost a lot of valuable ground, and we have certainly changed who we are right now as a country. He is not a good representative at all. I'm deeply saddened by what I'm seeing develop.
Do you have any sense of how his supporters sort of explain away things like that push or ignore it?
Yes, it's mind-boggling. I've got, for example, friends on Facebook, and they don't comment on this kind of thing. They care not. It's like they don't see it. It's like they have relegated every news source as fake and anything that we actually can see him saying and doing as if he didn't say it and didn't do it. Or they've had a grand lobotomy. I mean, Trump is so inconsistent. He ridiculed Obama for bowing down to the Saudis, and we see him curtsy, for goodness sake. So, yes, I mean, I've been deeply troubled, saddened, and it's amazing to me to see so many people that I've always thought of as intelligent, bright, loving, caring people. But when it comes to Trump, it just doesn't matter what he does or says.
Kiana, thank you very much for calling the show. We're talking about the week in the news. Susan, Michael, and Jack, let's move on to some other international news. This one extremely tragic. Here's a Kabul shopkeeper speaking to Al Jazeera after Wednesday morning's huge truck bombing. The death toll, apparently at least 90, at least 500 wounded.
It was really powerful, and our shop was totally damaged. One of our workers has been taken to hospital after he was wounded. I've never seen such a terrible explosion in my life.
Jack Beattie, this has been a morass for a very long time. Do you have any perspective on how this ends, if this ever ends?
Well, it doesn't seem like it's going to end in any definitive way with the addition of 3,000 to 5,000 U.S. troops to help aid and train the Afghan security forces. That's what the generals want, and maybe they'll get it. And they claim, or they hope, that that will break the, quote, stalemate. But the stalemate, according to the Financial Times, the Afghan government only controls about a quarter of its own country, facing the Taliban and an ISIS insurgency. So the situation there is just as dire as it can possibly be after 16 years. You know, Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, was once asked, what's the first law of politics? And he said, never invade Afghanistan. We have, and we're there. And offstage, we have Pakistan, who may be the group that perhaps did this bombing, is connected to the Pakistani security forces. And we continue to provide aid to Pakistan. Pakistan continues to provide aid to these groups that bring terror to Afghanistan. And so we are funding the terror that we're complaining about. This is the most pointless and self-defeating policy I think the United States has engaged in my lifetime. And it's through what? The Bush administration, the Obama administration, and today we go on with Pakistan as if there's no trouble at all about this.
I think this is a big decision that President Trump is facing. A recommendation earlier this month from the Pentagon, or last month, I guess, we're now into June, for thousands of additional U.S. troops to be dispatched there. And that would risk the kind of greater engagement and involvement that President Trump criticized and said he wasn't going to engage in during when he was campaigning for this office. And yet the failure to send more U.S. troops risks the kind of morass that we see there, where after this investment of blood and treasure on the part of Americans for almost 16 years, what will it come to? I think this is an important issue to watch for the president.
A bit of domestic tragic news before we end this hour. I want to touch on Tamir Rice. That's the 12-year-old who in 2014 was fatally shot by a Cleveland police officer as he held a pellet gun. That police officer who shot him was fired this week, and here's an explanation for why.
They fired him for lying on his application, which I wish they would have fired him for killing Tamir.
And in related race news, we heard earlier this week that LeBron James' racist graffiti on his house in L.A. LeBron spoke very poignantly and honestly publicly about the enduring issue of racism in the United States. Michael Shearer, this may not exactly be your area in terms of coverage, but do you want to sort of end the hour by talking about this persistent, terrible problem in the United States at so many levels?
Yeah, two things jump to mind. One, I think LeBron James is really emerging as an enormously important public figure. And it's different from other sports stars like Michael Jordan or Tom Brady, who kept themselves rather private, kept their opinions private, didn't get too involved in politics. I think it's something to watch. He's not only a great sports star, but his ability to speak movingly about things that are happening to us is I think, increasingly important. The other thing is that this issue of racial police violence is going to be defined over the next several years by the fight over what the federal policy is in terms of guiding police departments to reform themselves. And Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, has really dramatically shifted us away from the Obama administration policy, which was to work hard to reform police departments.
Sessions. Michael Shearer of Time, thank you for that. We're about to end our hour. Thank you very much for coming on the show. Also, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty. Susan, Michael, Jack, thank you very much to all of you and have a great weekend.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up Monday, President Trump blasted the Paris Accord as unfair to coal miners. Does abandoning the deal mean a boom for the coal industry? I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.